KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm excited to have on the show Professor Mario Biagioli, who is a prolific writer in the history of science, and with whom we are going to be focusing on an article that he's written for a book that many authors have contributed to, which he is co-editing with Peter Jazzy and Martha Woodmansey, called Making and Unmaking Intellectual Property, Creative Production in a Legal and Cultural Perspective. Mario has written extensively about the history of science in a variety of settings. He is currently the Distinguished Professor of Law and Science and Technology Studies at UC Davis School of Law, where he heads up its new Center for Innovation Studies. And today we're going to be focusing on a very relatively, or at least sounding, narrow topic that I think has wide implications, which is the patent specification. Patents, as you may know, certainly we've discussed at some length with a number of guests on the show, are one of the four primary ways that one can protect intellectual property. Patents involve a very arduous regulatory process in order to get one, and part of what you need to do in order to get a patent is to fill out basically what are called specifications, which we are going to discuss in more detail, but basically involve detailed descriptions of what you have invented, what you propose should be patented. And the specification is part of the bargain that patent law calls for. It's part of the quid pro quo that says that we will, as a government, give the inventor a limited monopoly in return for the ability of others to learn what that invention is and how it works so that it can be improved upon, not used in the form as listed in the patent, but it used in perhaps other ways to build upon it, to improve upon it, to change it, and so forth. The patent specification is a big part of that disclosure requirement in patent law, and Mario's article takes a look at the history of the specification and ties the history of how and what specification was required to the system of property that existed in this country going back to its founding, a society that went and was certainly built upon problems with authority, problems with authoritarianism, and went towards a political representative democracy, and how the specification fit into that. As part of our larger discussion, we will also discuss the role of secrecy in IP law as well as more generally, and what ultimately the specification means for patent law, but more broadly for how we conceive IP law generally. And again, as I said, Mario is a Distinguished Professor of Law and Science and Technology Studies at UC Davis School of Law. He was previously a professor of history of science at Harvard University, where he specialized in intellectual property in science. He's taught at a variety of schools. He's written several books, including a book that would be a wonderful topic for the show, and we're going to talk about a little bit, involving Galileo and secrecy. He is a former Guggenheim Fellow, and he is a founding member of the International Society for the Theory and History of Intellectual Property. He is joining us via Skype from his home in Berkeley. Mario, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Good morning, Dave. Great to be on your show.
Let's start off, Mario, with a question that I ask virtually all of my guests, which is you a bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
Actually, my background is fairly uncanonical for somebody who does what I do. I started out as doing computer science. And then I, believe it or not, I became a photographer. And then I tried to become a philosopher of science and settled for a historian of science. And that's what I've been for about the last 20 years. And as I was working on the history of science, I got increasingly interested in intellectual property. And I've kind of self-trained in IP, and now I do both. I have a joint appointment in the law school and in the science and technology studies program.
And as someone who is not trained as a lawyer, writing about intellectual property law, or indeed any law, can be a challenge. Can you talk a little bit, and I've had some guests on talk about this before, can you talk a bit about the challenges of writing about law in the context of, in your case, being a historian?
Well, so the good thing about being a historian and working in law and specifically intellectual property is that you are forced to kind of recognize that, you know, the modern legal concepts are, you know, highly constructed. That is, you know, they're really part of this kind of long development of legal doctrine. And if you do any history, you're bound to find that, you know, people in the past had, you know, radically, you know, radically, you know, different notions and practices about what we now call intellectual property. So for me, actually, it was the difference, you know, reading a modern IP textbook, and then, you know, trying to apply that to, you know, scientists in the 16th and 17th century really didn't work. So it was heuristically, it was very interesting to have to confront how, you know, how kind of a peculiar modern intellectual property law looks if you approach it from, you know, a 16th or 17th century perspective. So that's the plus. The con is that if you are not trained as, you know, as a lawyer, I think, at least, you know, I'm really just speaking for myself. I don't know how other people who have done what I've done, you know, may feel about this, is that you tend, or at least I tend, perhaps to focus on the doctrine, you know, rather than, say, you know, the details of, say, a, you know, the kind of arguments that people develop in an infringement case. So I don't have the kind of the experience, on the ground. So I tend to have a kind of a perhaps a little bit of an artificially theorized version of, you know, of modern, you know, patent law, because, you know, I don't practice it.
Do you find, as again, as a historian, that being, let me ask it another way, the standard of legal research is analytically very rigorous in terms of being able to and needing to piece together specific facts in order to tailor it to a certain argument and structure it in a certain way. And while there is certainly creativity in legal writing, it is circumscribed by a lot of very strong rules that make legal writing a challenge especially for people coming out of the humanities. Do you find in writing about law that you run into those kinds of challenges where you have a bit more freedom in terms of how you structure discussion and analysis when you write in history or in other areas in the humanities?
It's true that, you know, when you start reading, you know, a lot of your articles, you need to get into the, you know, the specific language. I mean, not to mention when you start reading, you know, patent applications and you are confronted with that kind of very, very weird language used to write up, you know, patent claims. But actually, as a historian, you know, especially somebody, you know, who has worked, on early modern material, the difference in language and modes of argumentation is really not a big deal, because, I'm accustomed to it. You know, if you read the texts of, say, a 17th century, you know, astronomer, mathematician, or natural historian, they don't argue the way we do, and they don't construct their sentences the way we do. So legal language is not a problem. It's just another kind of interesting, weird language. What I find a little peculiar, and this is something that I tease my law colleagues about, is the genre of the law review article compared to, the article in, social sciences or humanities journals, where most of the time the editors really does not want to give you, any more space than you need. And reading, law review articles, sometimes I'm struck by, the first 15 pages that are used, by the author to tell you what he or she will do in the rest of the article, which, I think most social sciences journals would just, the editor would just, excise those 15 pages and just, tell you, cut to the chase. So the reading law review articles, it takes a little adjustment, not because of the nature of the language, but because of the sometimes they're not as to the point as they could be.
And that, and it's, these are part of the idiomatic structures of law review articles that I think also run into some problems as we attempt to, at least in law academia, make articles shorter and shorter. Where at some point decisions will have to be made that I generally agree with you that the repetition of points several times perhaps is unnecessary, which of course is ironic given the fact that we generally teach our students to be direct and to the point and to not use extraneous words. With regard to the work that you've done, Mara, before we return towards patents and the anthology that you're co-editing, your prior work and a lot of your work has focused on Galileo, and particularly your book Galileo's Instruments of Credit. And I'm curious to get your perspective on the relationship between Galileo and secrecy. Which I know is something you've written about extensively, because I think it ties in to the analysis that you're doing now with regard to patent specification. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I was interested. So the one of the points in Galileo's work that got me thinking about modern intellectual property was his development of the telescope. So there have been a long-standing debate, especially in philosophy of science, about the fact that, in 1609, 1610, Galileo hears about somebody in the Netherlands who had developed a telescope. He comes up with his own, instrument, and, he makes all sorts of very important discoveries, publishes a book on that in 1610, and basically, becomes an international star. From being a relatively unknown, mathematician in Padua, so he makes all these really astonishing claims. He argues that the surface of the moon is irregular, that Jupiter has four satellites, and other claims. And at the same time, he doesn't say anything about how the telescope works. So a lot of philosophers of science were puzzled by, how come. He's making, epistemologically astonishing claims, and he doesn't even bother, telling us how the telescope works, right? So, and they're right. Galileo does not, he just gives a little diagram of the telescope, but really doesn't get into any description of how, the refraction of light rays through, glass lenses would produce an enlarged image. And so I got interested in this because I noticed that Galileo had taken out a patent in a few years before, in the 1590s, for a water pump in Venice. And I noticed that in the patent application, he basically says close to nothing about how the pump works. So I got interested in the fact that he really was not disclosing much at all about neither his inventions, which he he successfully patented, or the instruments that enabled him to make these amazing discoveries. So that was kind of the entry point. So I start, reading more actual Venetian patents, and then, you know, Dutch patents, English patents, and so on. And I noticed that there was very, very, very little disclosure of the invention. So that basically secrecy, of this type, secrecy seemed to be basically a kind of the standard practice rather than the exception. So, and that's what got the project going.
And I'm curious, and we'll turn to patents in a moment, the modern patent specification in a moment. From what I'm hearing from you, secrecy was as much a part of the inventive process processes that you've studied as disclosure might be today. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. For instance, in Galileo's correspondence, I found there is at least one letter of a German, I think a German cardinal, who writes to Galileo and says, "Look, I've read your book. I see that you haven't disclosed, how the telescope works, and I would be happy to pay for the secret." So, which shows you that, this person didn't think that Galileo was doing anything weird by not disclosing. So, he kind of recognized, Galileo's right to his, secret, which is, close to a modern, trade secret. Mm-hmm. And he offered money to pay it. So there is no indication of any kind of moral, ethical condemnation for Galileo, for not disclosing how he built the telescope.
Is there any indication in your look not only at Galileo but in other patents going back several centuries that there would have been any incentive on the part of inventors to disclose information absent compulsion by way of a regulatory authority or the law?
No. And actually, I would say that, and this is something that I've done subsequently to the book, I now believe that there were disincentives to disclose as part of the application process. So, this may sound very weird to modern ears, but for instance, one of the things that I noticed is, especially in English early modern patents, is that there would be a stipulation or some arrangement according to which the inventor would just say a little bit about what the invention was in very, very general terms. We're talking just a couple of lines, and then he or she would promise to disclose more after the grant had been issued. Right, and this is something that I found in a variety of European countries, which suggests, at least that's how I read it, it suggests that people, that a lot of inventors and artisans did not trust the clerks who handled their applications. So in a sense, disclosing was not only risky because, your direct competitors might use what you have invented, but also that in the process of applying for a patent, you might lose the invention to a leak. The interesting thing is that I looked at the 1836 U.S. Patent Act that is in many ways still the platform for current U.S. patent law. It was only in 1836 that in that act it was stipulated that people working at the patent office could not develop any financial interest in the inventions that they were examining. And there is evidence that actually the first director of the patent office did get entangled in a dispute with an inventor who accused him of trying to insert himself in the patent, under threat of rejecting the application. So, if you want, the institutional firewalls that we now take for granted, meaning that a patent application is going to be held confidentially, blah blah blah, did not exist in the early modern period, and in the U.S. didn't exist until 1836. So a lot of inventors might have been at risk precisely when they were trying to get the patent, and not from their competitors, but from the very institution that was supposed to reward them.
We're chatting with Professor Mario Biagioli of UC Davis School of Law and KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, and we were recording the show on May 17th. We're airing on this day. Mario, that's fascinating, and of course, it gets into a broader issue that we have, which is ultimately the role of government and of law in intellectual property creation. And it seems from what you're saying that an argument could very strongly be made that in fact we need these institutions in place in order to protect the limited disclosure that we seek. In the absence of protections for violations based upon those disclosures, there would be none. Is that a lesson that we can draw from the history that you've done to be applied today, which gets us into specification?
Yes, I think that at least the historical material that I've been able to review, does suggest that not only you need kind of institutional safeguards, institutional and legal safeguards for inventors, but also, and this is something that it's weirder to think about. You also need the institutions to be, if you want, safe for the inventors, which they were not in the early modern period. And at this point, the fact that inventors had, probably they risked as much by negotiating with, their princes or local government as much as they did from the threat of being copied by direct competitors. Yes, it's an interesting lesson, I think.
And it's one that leads us to, I think, an interesting issue that you raise in the introduction to the book that is coming out. Correct?
It just came out last week.
Terrific. Okay, so perfect timing. In Making and Unmaking Intellectual Property, in your introduction, you and your co-editors talk about the state of intellectual property scholarship today, and particularly how the idea of innovation has become paramount. That same idea of innovation, of course, is implied in the work that Galileo did, indeed in the fact that inventors were inventing, and yet we focus more, from what I read in your introduction, we focus more on the idea of innovation now than we did before. How do you have a sense of why it is that this concept of innovation has become paramount today, where we have had innovation, obviously, going back centuries?
Yeah. I think that the definition of innovation and also the scale of innovation has changed, dramatically. So there is more and more of an emphasis on the new, for instance, but again by looking at the transition from early modern to modern, patent law. You see that, say, the notion of novelty that is crucial to patent law today. That in order to get a patent for an invention, you have to show that your invention is new compared to previous inventions. and that this this notion of novelty is global, you know, in a pretty strong sense. Instead, in the early modern period, novelty was strictly, you know, geographical, right? So, for instance, even if you look at the, you know, at the colonial patents in the U.S., you know, people would apply for a patent in Massachusetts or in North Carolina, and similarly, you know, in Europe, you would apply, you know, for an English patent or a Venetian patent or a Florentine patent. So novelty was limited to the political jurisdiction that issued the patent. So, for instance, you know, you could have somebody patent, you know, a water pump in Venice, and somebody was able to patent the same water pump, you know, water pump in Milan, exactly the same, right? So novelty, you know, and you know, and by extension, innovation was really meant very locally. And an interesting corollary of this kind of local notion of novelty and innovation is that you didn't need to be the person who invented something to get it patented. If you just brought a new invention to a place where it was not known or practiced, you could get a patent. So the, you know, the inventor was not necessarily the originator, but it could be just the importer, right? So from this scenario of kind of local novelty and innovation, when you come to, you know, modern patent law, both like in the late in the 1790s, you know, both in the U.S. and in France, you have this radical upscaling of novelty. That novelty now, it's a novelty, you know, everywhere. So it looks like there is a, so that the scale of the scale is not the right term, you know, the scope of that is implied in the notion of innovation, you know, changes. So it looks like if you look at you know, a bunch of a few centuries history, there seems to be a kind of a fairly continuous trend toward emphasizing you know, novelty and innovation, which was not there in the beginning, you know. And for instance, again, to give you a specific example, you know, Galileo was rewarded by the Venetian Senate for the telescope that he offered them, and I tend to read that as, you know, a kind of a patent application, despite the fact that they knew very, very well that this was not the first telescope, but that other people in Northern Europe had, you know, had developed it. So they were rewarding the limited innovation that Galileo had achieved, you know, on the telescope. And instead, now it's innovation is meant, you know, much more generally, though. I would also say that there is a great deal of rhetoric in innovation. That is, innovation, it's a tough concept to nail down, because it seems to be applied to so many things that it's basically difficult to be sure that innovation is always new, given how broadly it is applied today.
And it's certainly, I mean, that's part of the significant criticism that has been leveled not only at patent law, but at the Patent and Trademark Office, and being able to police for those inventions that are truly novel and not obvious from those that are not. Yes. We are chatting with Professor Mario Biagioli of the UC Davis School of Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on a station, KZSU, that is both nonprofit and non-commercial, and therefore requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. Mario, let's turn in this second half of our interview towards your recent work on specification in particular. And for those that aren't familiar, and I gave a brief introduction, could you describe in a little bit more detail what a patent specification is and where it fits in the patent application as a whole?
So the specification, it has a number of functions. So from the, you know, at the level of, if you want, you know, political economy of the patent system, the specification is part of effectively a contract between the inventor and you know, and the public. So the inventor discloses what the invention is, and is supposed to do so with a sufficient detail to allow a third party to replicate the invention. And you know, and the government standing, you know, the government, you know, that is stands as the, you know, the elected representative of the citizens, of the public, then in exchange for this disclosure, you know, grants the inventor a, you know, a temporary monopoly on you know, on the invention. So basically you have a quid pro quo, i.e. The inventor discloses the knowledge of the invention, and in exchange, you know, gets a exclusive exclusionary rights on the invention for a little while. And because the disclosure of the invention, once the patent expires, you know, there is enough information for other people to jump in and reproduce it and use it for free. So that's the kind of the general the justification for the specification. More technically, the specification is effect, you know, is the description of what the invention is, and is often analogized to a kind of a the property map. That is, the inventor, you know, lays out what the invention is, and those are the claims on which he or she wants intellectual property. So is the, if you want, is the map of the property claimed by the inventor.
The idea of the specification you talk about in the article is one that you tie into the politics and political economy of the day. So perhaps before we discuss a bit the contrast with trade secrecy, which I find particularly fascinating, how does the specification make patents more politically palatable? And what does your analysis of the history show us?
So I think there are two, in my view, the introduction of specifications, you know, in the U.S. and in France in the 1790s, it does really reflect a major political change, but also it has a major conceptual change. You know, it has a major conceptual impact on patent law. So let me discuss those two things separately. So basically, what I am arguing is that prior to the introduction of specifications, the patent was not a right. I mean, if you today, you still have to jump through the hoops. You have to fulfill, you know, certain requirements in order to get a patent. But the patent itself is not conceived as, you know, as a gift that the government gives you. Is that, you know, you are entitled to a patent provided that you fulfill certain requirements. Instead, in the early modern period, the language of patents is clearly the language of gift. That is, you know, the inventor is not entitled to a patent. It's only if, you know, the political authorities, be, you know, the king or the local, city senate, it's up to them to decide whether they want to give you a patent as a gift. And in fact, the term that is used is privilege, okay? And the patent application is often called a supplication, which again tells you that we are not operating within the discourse of rights. We're really operating in a discourse of gifts, not contracts. You know, the inventor offers an invention to the political authority, and the political authority may or may not decide to give a counter gift in the form of a privilege. So I was struck by, if you want, the lack of the discourse of rights in early patent discourse and practices. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that it was quite striking that the first two laws that required specifications were both developed right after two major political revolutions. So in France, right after the French Revolution, and in the U.S. also right after the independence was achieved. And so, you know, the patent bargain that you were talking about, this exchange between the public and the inventor in the form of a contract, in a sense, is made possible by a new political regime where now the government is not, if you want, the private rule of a king, but is, the government is made up of representatives who have been elected, by the people. So it's the kind of radical shift in, if you want, the political regime that, in a sense, reconceptualizes the invention, you know, not as something that the inventor offers to the ruler, perhaps in exchange for a privilege, but is something that the inventor is entitled to have protected, you know, as a right. I'm trying to say that the introduction of the political introduction of the patent specification is both made possible and also made necessary by the new regimes, the new political regimes that were installed in the U.S. and in France. So that's the political part.
The idea of the patent monopoly is one that historically was viewed as an embarrassment. In other words, that it was unfortunate almost, but certainly there was a sense of humility with regard to handing anyone a monopoly, at least in the law, without having a significant payback. Do you sense that sense, and I'm using the word, although there might be, probably is a better word for it, do you have a sense that the mere granting of the monopoly, viewed as something generally negative, itself changed as the patent specification became more important, that it became not only palatable from a political standpoint, but it became palatable from an economic standpoint because the sting of granting a monopoly was lessened?
Yes, I believe so. And you start seeing the critique of monopolies actually starts earlier. In England, you have the Statute of Monopolies, I think it was 1624, and basically was triggered by a feeling that the Crown was granting too many monopolies. So not just patents, but monopolies on the importation of certain goods, or monopolies on certain industries in certain places, and and so on. And so in this statute of monopolies, what you find is for the first time that patents for inventions are seen as legitimate, because they are supposed to be about new things. Okay, so that's I think the crucial part of the justification of the patent system. That is, I'm not going to apply for a patent to make bread in the way in which bread has been made for centuries and millennia. I may apply for a patent to make bread with a new technology. So even if I get this patent on my own special way of bread making, I do not prevent people from continuing to make bread the way they've always done. So the first step to make monopolies, or at least patents, more legitimate was to say that they are only about something new, right? So and because of that, you effectively do not take away anything from the people that they already had. So so basically, you just create a new property, and you control it, right? So that was the first step. So the connection between, or at least trying to say that patents for inventions are not just standard monopolies, because they are about things that are new. So that's the first step. But what you don't find in the early modern period is disclosure of what the invention is. So the public really, you do have little descriptions and kind of limited disclosures, but they're not enabling in the modern sense of patent law. That is, there are no descriptions that would allow a third party to be able to reproduce the patent. So you have, on one hand, the development of a conceptualization of an invention as something new, and therefore, because it's new, protecting it would not generate a bad monopoly. But the knowledge of the invention is not disclosed. So there is no contribution, if you want, to the public domain. So this is, taking off my hat as a historian, because as a historian, you're not supposed to criticize what people in the past did. But speaking as a, a modern citizen, this was a very problematic state of affairs. At the same time, to give the early modern people a little bit of credit, what they did, and this is something that patent law has effectively forgot about, is that you didn't need to disclose your invention if you were an inventor in order to get a patent, but you had to show that it worked. So, so it wasn't all bad. People did not, the public domain was not enriched by the disclosure of the invention. And at the same time, patents would not be issued, or they could be voided unless the inventor had shown that this thing worked. So there were, if you want, some safeguards. It's not that people could just patent whatever they wanted, really, without saying what it was. There was this major safeguard that, compared to the modern requirement of reduction to practice, was, I think, substantially tougher. People really, I would say that in the early modern period, the requirement was effectively a working requirement, not just a reduction to practice. That you really had to show a prototype or the actual machine at work. So to wrap up, the early modern patent law, I mean, if we can call it a law, mm-hmm. Early modern patent practice did not involve disclosure. At the same time, you can see the development of a discourse to separate patents from bad monopolies. And although there wasn't disclosure, there were other safeguards to basically cut down on patents for inventions that didn't work.
We're chatting with Professor Mario Biagioli of the UC Davis School of Law. Mario, I'm at the unfair portion of the show, and I call it unfair because we have about 7 minutes left, and I start asking questions that can't be answered adequately in the time that we have left. But I ask them anyway, as the host's prerogative. A couple of quick closing points. You chatted, and I mentioned a little bit the contrast with trade secrecy. I'm curious to get your view whether you see trade secrecy as an enemy of knowledge, knowledge dissemination in particular. And this is a topic that I write about, but I'm curious to get your thoughts. I mean, do you see trade secrecy in that vein? And do you see secrecy generally in IP on the rise again after perhaps, based upon the history you've looked at, a dip in its prevalence?
So, again, I think that the role or the problems with trade secrets, I think it changes dramatically in time. In the sense that, say, if you look at early modern scenarios, right, where the notion of innovation is really conceptualized in very very local terms, right? So each country, and sometimes we're talking about really, small countries. In early modern Germany, countries were pretty much as big as a city, right? So people have, very local technology policies, right? So in a sense, I don't think that trade secrets in that context were particularly bad, largely because there was really not much of a difference between a trade secret and a patent, because effectively a patent didn't disclose. The patent didn't force the inventor to disclose. So it's not like today, where the trade secret is often contrasted with a patent. The patent requires disclosure, the trade secret doesn't. In the early modern period, basically, patents were just a formalized trade secret. There wasn't really much of a difference. Now, in the modern period, it's tougher to say, because one could say, well, look, trade secrets, they're bad because there is no contribution to the public domain. At the same time, you can reverse engineer them. So, the protection that a trade secret gets is not the protection that a patent gets. So, in a sense, you don't give, but you don't get back much either. So, in that sense, I don't see any major objection to trade secrecy, though. And here I'm referring to to your work. It seems to me that, if trade secrets involve innovations and inventions that are relevant, they're part of the infrastructure. One of the examples you give is the voting machines, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that and the functioning of the voting machine is something that needs to be transparent to to guarantee the transparency of the political process, of the voting process. So you have, I think, those clashes where basically the logic of the trade secret, if it migrates into innovation, inventions that are infrastructural, then it clashes with other political requirements. So I think that the trade secrets do get problematic when they spill into infrastructural innovations. I'm not sure that they are problematic if in the commercial, in the purely commercial domain. But I don't have a lot of evidence. I guess that that's part of the beast, right?
Right.
Evidence about trade secrets is hard to come by.
Well, my concern with trade secrecy has been almost exclusively when trade secrecy interferes with acquisition of information that the public might have an interest in knowing beyond reasons involving commercial competition, where I don't have a significant quarrel, although there's a growing use of trade secrecy even in the commercial context, which has broader public policy implications. But let's close a discussion with reference to the last sentence in the chapter that you've contributed to the book, The Making and Unmaking of IP, and the chapter is entitled Patent Specification and Political Representation, How Patents Became Rights. You make a reference at the close of your article by suggesting that we might move beyond intellectual property rights. And I'm curious, and again, an unfair question because we have about 2 minutes left, what did you mean by that statement?
So what I meant, two things. The first part was historical in the sense that, the discourse of rights, private right, personal rights, is obviously something that comes up with after the big revolutions, the French Revolution, the American revolutions. And these are really concepts. So, the rights, the discourse of rights is a tool against what is seen as the arbitrary nature of the older political regime, right? So, so rights is not that they've always existed. It's a kind of a discourse, a conceptual and legal tool and political tool that emerges at a certain time. So it's clear to me that it was good that we adopted the discourse of rights at that time. Now, but if you historicize the notion of rights, it's not clear to me that one necessarily need to hold on to rights in the context of intellectual property at this point. And a kind of an experiment that I find very interesting is following the debates over the protection of, say, traditional knowledge. So the protection of, say, knowledge about medical properties of plants in developing countries. So because of the different framework and legal and cultural framework, there are a lot of discussions about how to reward these people for the knowledge that they have and they're willing to make public without necessarily using the discourse of intellectual property rights. So I think that these conversations, they're triggered by the Convention on Biological Diversity and so on. They show that at least that there are ways in which one can think about ways to reward people for knowledge, useful knowledge, without necessarily going, the patent or copyright route.
And I think there, Mario, we're going to have to stop, although I will invite you back to continue this discussion. Mario, for those people that want to learn more about your work, do you have any places on the web or elsewhere that they can go?
Yes, the Center for Science and Innovation Studies at Davis. I have a page there with a lot of my work, and I think it's innovation.ucdavis.edu.
Mario Biagioli, professor at UC Davis School of Law. Mario, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. It's fascinating work, and I mean that invitation sincerely. I look forward to having you back on the show.
It was a pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Let me mention a couple of guests rounding out this quarter, which ends pretty much at the end of May. During June, KZSU will be in interim, and there will not be new shows, but we will have new shows kicking in at the end of June and early July for the summer quarter 2011. But rounding out this quarter will be next week Professor Kevin Warbach of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and closing the quarter, Professors Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord, my colleagues at Elon University, discussing online sales taxation. For the summer, I'm looking forward to interviewing, among other people, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants, Andrew Renz, a research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, as well as Professor Michael Risch of Villanova University School of Law, discussing his work in patents. There are a number of other guests that I intend to have on the show. I am extending invitations this week. If you have any suggestions for people that should be on the show, or any other comments about Hearsay Culture, you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, there are several ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU FM Stanford, either in the Bay Area or by streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu. The show airs on KZSU Tuesdays from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also get the show by podcast by going either to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous shows as well as the schedule of upcoming guests. You can also get the show by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society iTunes page, where you can get all of the Hearsay Culture shows as well as other events that occur at Stanford CIS. Or you can go to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.